I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is psychotherapist and relationship expert Esther Perel. And now, join Stephanie Singer on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Esther Perel.
Esther Perel is here with us this evening. A psychotherapist and New York Times bestselling author, she's widely recognized as one of today's most insightful and original voices on modern relationships. Fluent in 9 languages, she helms a private therapy practice in New York City and serves as an organizational consultant for Fortune 500 companies around the world. Her celebrated TED Talks have garnered nearly 20 million views, and her international bestseller, Mating in Captivity, Unlocking Erotic Intelligence, is a global phenomenon translated into 24 languages. Esther is also an executive producer and host of the popular Audible original podcast, Where Should We Begin? In her new best-selling book, The State of Affairs, Rethinking Infidelity, Esther takes a look at modern relationships through the lens of infidelity. Affairs, she argues, have a lot to teach us, what we expect, what we think we want, and what we feel entitled to. Please join me in welcoming back to the JCCSF, Esther Perel.
Good evening. Let me ask you something. How many of you would say that you are currently in a relationship? And how many of you would like to be in a relationship? And how many of you would like to be out of the relationship you're in? At least on sometimes. Thank you for your honesty. You see, we all live in networks of relationships all the time. And if you think about friendship, it hasn't changed too much in the last 150 years. If you think about relationship between siblings, it hasn't changed too much. But there's one unit that has undergone an extreme makeover, and that's the couple. Nothing resembles the couples of 200 years ago. And I've been a couples therapist for 30-something years. It's a rather new profession, because for most of history, it didn't really matter too much how well the couple was doing, because the family was the central unit. And today, this couple has more pressure put on it to do well, to be happy, to be perfect, with less resources to support it than ever before. Relationships expectations are at an all-time high, and yet nobody really knows what happens in the backstage of a couple. Sometimes in straight couples, women will talk to women, and men will talk to nobody. This is not funny. When it comes to sex, just about everybody lies. And when it comes to forbidden sex, it's even more so. So I have decided to, for my whole life's work, to look at what are the challenges of modern relationships. And particularly, I got interested in looking at relationships and their intersection with sexuality. And why sexuality? Because in every culture, in every society, looking through the lens of sexuality is to get a glimpse as to what are the most archaic, rooted, traditional aspects of a culture which manifest around the beliefs and the attitudes about sex, and also looking at the most progressive, radical changes in a culture. You can look at it through its attitudes and beliefs about sex. So it's a lens into a society, into a couple, and into a person. And I wanted to take the couple back into the central square with the book and with the podcast. You know, it wasn't too long ago that the walls were porous in the village and you basically could hear the fights of every couple next door. Today, some of your close friends can divorce or break up and you didn't see it coming and you're surprised. Because the isolation is very big. And that bringing conversations like this into the public space, what we're going to do tonight, is really what I am committed to at this point. So, why infidelity? Why would somebody start and do a book about one of the most taboo topics? It's really one of the last taboos left. And what is it about me that wants to speak about the unspoken all the time? And then we could have a session about that. You know, but one thing I know is that here is this thing called infidelity that pretty much has existed since marriage was invented. And it's shrouded in secrecy, it's shrouded in shame, and it is filled with judgment. There is no vocabulary that is morally neutral to even talk about this. Except in the arts. In the arts, they talk about love stories. In opera, they talk about love stories, but not in our society. And I think we can create a different approach that is more compassionate and more caring for all the people who have experienced this. So if I am to ask you, how many of you would say that you have been affected by the experience of infidelity in your life? Wait. Wait. You could be the child of a parent who was unfaithful, or a parent who fell in love with another person. You can be the offspring of an illicit love. You can be the friend whose shoulder is wet because somebody's been weeping on it so much. You can be the friend who has been recruited as the confidant in someone else who is enthralled into an affair. You can be one of the three primary protagonists, and you can be the person who closes the triangle. So how many of you would say that you have been affected by the experience of infidelity in your lives? All right. Just understand this. This is every night like this. It's 80 to 90%. It's not just a few bad apples. It's ubiquitous, it's common, and it's quite poorly understood. And so I began to write about that, I would say 2.5 years ago. And at this very moment, in all corners of the world, someone is either cheating or being cheated on, thinking about having an affair, offering advice to someone who's in the throes of one, or completing the triangle as the secret lover. No aspect of a couple's lives elicits more fear, gossip, and fascination than an affair. Adultery has existed since marriage was invented, and so too the taboo against it. It has been legislated, debated, politicized, and demonized throughout history. And yet, despite its widespread denunciation, infidelity has a tenacity that marriage can only envy. So much so that it is the only sin that gets two commandments in the Bible. One for doing it, and one just for thinking about it. In every society, on every continent, and in every era, regardless of the penalties and the deterrents, men and women have slipped the confines of matrimony. Almost everywhere people marry, monogamy is the official norm, and infidelity the clandestine one. So what are we to make of this time-honored taboo, universally forbidden, yet universally practiced? The revelation of an affair can be so wrecking, it's no surprise that most people want to take sides. So whenever I tell someone that I'm writing a book about infidelity, the immediate reaction is for or against. As if there are only two options. My answer is yes. And behind this cryptic response lies my sincere desire to initiate a more nuanced and less judgmental conversation about infidelity and its concomitant dilemmas. The intricacies of love and desire don't yield to simple categorizations of good and bad, victim and culprit. To be clear, not condemning does not mean condoning, and there's a world of difference between understanding and justifying. But when we reduce the conversation to simply passing judgment, we are left with no conversation at all. So here's how I would like to start the conversation. I think to understand modern infidelity, we have to understand modern relationships, modern love, modern marriage. And so I want to walk you through a little bit of a history to give it context. One of the greatest changes that is occurring is that for so long, relationships were organized around duty and obligation. And that's what it was like when we lived in the villages. In these villages, there was very little uncertainty because everybody knew what was expected. You knew what you were meant to do. You got your sense of identity and your sense of belonging and your sense of continuity. You didn't get much freedom, but you got more certainty. And in a very short amount of time, in that village, by the way, relationships, marriages, I'm going to call them marriages because that was the primary model for committed relationships, were quite pragmatic. They were often economically organized. And in that context, infidelity was an economic threat, primarily on women. This is a topic that has never enjoyed any gender equality. This is a topic that has had massive double standard, with male privilege pretty much across the world, with practically a license to cheat. So monogamy was primarily an imposition on women for economic reasons, in order to know whose children I should feed and who gets the cows when I die. This concept of monogamy as being the sacred cow of the romantic ideal, as being an expression of conviction of lifelong abiding love, is a rather recent definition for monogamy. In a very short amount of time, we move to the cities. And as we arrive to the cities, we become a lot more free, but also a lot more alone. And as we become a lot more alone, our intimate relationships take on a new meaning. For most of the time before, intimacy pretty much accompanied relationships, sometimes as a side project. If it was there, it was nice. If it wasn't there, as long as the basic aspects of marriage were covered, food, shelter, surviving, economic support, family life, the base needs of the Maslow ladder, then the marriage was considered solid. As I become more and more in need of a partner, since I don't have but this big community, intimacy becomes the central feature of the relationship. And now its meaning is no longer that we're going to work the land, milk the cows, and raise the children. No, intimacy becomes into me see. And into me see means that I'm going to share my most prized assets with you. And that is not my dowry. That is my internal life. I come to you with my feelings, my worries, my aspirations, my anxieties, my dreams. And when I talk to you, I want eye contact. I want you not to be doing this. I want to know that you are going to reflect back to me, that you are going to validate me, that you are going to empathize with me, and that I'm going to momentarily transcend my existential aloneness. Into me, see. As we become more and more free, a number of major changes start to happen. We bring love to marriage, and we bring sex to love. And thanks to the greatest sexual revolution called the democratization of contraception, for the first time we separate sexuality from its mere reproductive function. And we no longer just have sex inside committed relationships in order to have 8 children, which will be an economic asset for us, because right now they're an economic drain. We want 1 or 2 of them. And if we are going to stay connected, or 3 or 4 maybe, but if we're going to stay connected sexually with each other, we don't just want sex for reproduction. We want an erotic life. We want the poetics of sex. We want sexuality for connection and for pleasure. And then not only do we bring sex to love and love to marriage, and we tie them together, as in we for the first time even link the possibility of marital satisfaction and or marital happiness with sexual satisfaction. But on top of it, we do something fundamentally new with happiness to begin with. I mean, for most of history, marriage belonged to the heavens. If you suffered well on earth, you could hope for a little reward in the Olam Haba, you know, in the afterlife. But no, we brought the happiness down. First it became an option, and now it's a mandate. So never has there been more pressure on our intimate relationships to be happy, whatever that means. And it's not so much that we have new desires today, but we certainly feel more entitled to pursue our desires because that is one of the fruits of an individualistic, consumer-oriented society. I deserve this. I can't live like this any longer. My kids would want me to see me happy. Wouldn't they want to see me happy? I mean, it just goes all over. This notion that that pursuit of happiness justifies major acts of exuberant defiance. And then, this is just the beginning. Then a few other things start to happen. So, we used to marry and we had sex for the first time. And now we marry and we stop having sex with others. Monogamy forever was one person for life. And at this moment, monogamy is one person at a time. And many of you here have probably said, I am monogamous in all my relationships. Plural. And it makes perfect sense. But this means that this concept has already evolved throughout history. This is not the first time we're tampering with it. In fact, the greatest shift on monogamy was the abolition of the mandate for virginity. And then we start to do another few things. We're looking for the one and only. Many people talk about our partners like our soulmates. And in our secularized society, we have basically replaced religion with romantic love. And this is the work of a wonderful analyst called Robert Johnson, who basically says, if you look at what we're looking for in relationships these days, we want transcendence, we want ecstasy, we want meaning, we want belonging, we want wholeness. All these things we used to look for in the sanctuary of the divine, not in the perfection of earthly love. When we call somebody a soulmate, we are basically conflating the spiritual and the relational. And when we used to say the one and only, it used to mean God, not another person next to me. And at the same time as we have this religious system, we add to it another foundational cultural influence, which is consumerism. And this means that for the first time, I'm not just choosing between two people in my village, because now I have 1,000 people at my fingertips. And when I have 1,000 people at my fingertips and I am going to find the one and only, that one and only means something completely different. It is the one that's going to cure me of my FOMO. You are going to capture my imagination in such a way that I am no longer thinking I could do better. For you, my one and only, I will delete my apps. I hope you laugh in recognition. Because it's not always funny. But, you know, this notion of that pursuit does such a thing that we are today, in 1960, about 80% of people in their 20s were married. Today it's 20%. So it means that we have 2 decades almost, for some of us, of sexual nomadism. And serial monogamies or non-monogamies, but serial relationships. And when we come together, we no longer doing this as a cornerstone. We're doing it as a capstone. And the capstone model is one in which you and I meet when we have already worked so hard. We've already sown our oats. It's in recognition for my authentic self that you choose me, chosen at my essence. And when there is an infidelity, it's rejected at my essence.
You're listening to psychotherapist and relationship expert Esther Perel, whose new book is The State of Affairs, on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Infidelity today is the shattering of the grand ambition of love. Because if I'm your one and only, and that means that I don't need anything else anymore, and this happens, then maybe I'm not indispensable or unique or irreplaceable. I'm not that special after all. And if affairs have always been painful, they have become today traumatic. They are a leading cause of divorce. 91% of Americans think that it is more morally wrong to commit an infidelity than to commit suicide or cloning. That's the Pew report of 2013. It's not the same in every part of the world, but since we are talking here, it gives us a bit of a context. If I am, and not only that, but if we have a model of a one and only, then it also means that if there is an infidelity, there must be something missing. This is the symptom model. If you have everything you need at home, there should be no reason to go looking elsewhere. If you go looking elsewhere, it must mean there was something missing. And either there is something missing in the relationship or there's something missing in you. But millions of people can't all be pathological. And nobody wants to understand what is at stake in this. So I began to think about it as a dual model, as a dual perspective. That if I want to grapple with this subject, I need to understand what the impact, but also the meanings and the motives. What it did to you and what it meant for me. And one of the great findings, actually, that defied this notion that there must be something wrong, was one of the great surprises for the study. And this research began in 2009. The writing began 2.5 years ago, but I started to travel the globe and just do sessions, interviews, public conferences like that on this subject. And even people in satisfying relationships cheat. In fact, it happens in good marriages, bad marriages, open marriages, non-monogamous, polyamory, gay, straight, it happens. It's a fact. And when I began to ask myself, why would it happen even in satisfying relationships, I began to hear this sentence all along. It's not that I want to leave my partner. It's not that I want to reject my relationship. When I am drawn to the gaze of another, it's because I want to leave the person who I have myself become. It's not that I want to leave the person that I'm with or that I want to find another person, but I am dying to find another version of myself. And then I began to think that at the heart of affair lies betrayal, lying, duplicity, secrecy, all of that. But at the heart of affair also often lies longing and loss and yearning and self-seeking. I began to look first on the experience of the person that is wounded. What happens today that makes this crisis so unredeemable sometimes? You know, for most of history, there was no divorce. There was no exit. You married, it was for life. Till death do us apart. Today, it's pretty much till love dies. And people would wonder why, when we have so much divorce, hasn't it rendered infidelity obsolete if you can leave? Because many people don't want to leave. Actually, they very much want to be where they are. They like the life they have. They understand the difference between a love story and a life story. They sometimes have love stories with other people, knowing them well that they would never be able to live with them. And the selfishness of it is built in. By definition, when you transgress, it is an act of entitlement. It is a selfish act, because you are thinking about you at the expense of what it will do to somebody else. But that is not the purpose of it. That comes with it. Because it has become the shattering of the grand ambition of love, it also becomes a loss of identity. it's like I don't know anymore who I am. But when I'm in Morocco, when I'm in West Africa, and when I talk with people from those parts of the world, the notion is I had bad luck. I still know who I am because I am a daughter, in this case, of many, many siblings. I have a whole community around me. I know who I am. I'm deeply, deeply hurt, but I don't have a crisis of identity where I say, I don't know anymore who I am. I can't trust my entire story. I thought I knew my life. Now I have no idea what it is. And not only can't I trust you, my partner, but I can't even trust my own perception. This has shattered my entire sense of reality. Because it's one thing to not be able to trust the future because it's an unknown. But usually we believe that we know our past. And this experience has the capacity to make us doubt if everything that we went through was actually real. So I want to play you a little clip. It's called The Shreds. This is from the podcast.
That I found that was of he and I during that time was torn to shreds. Anything, my wedding dress. I had our wedding vows on tape. Cut that to shreds because that wasn't real. Right. You don't stand up in front of all these people, make these vows to me, and then a month later, break them. It wasn't real.
We all understand that the future is unpredictable, but we expect that our past will be dependable and that we can look back and trust what we experienced. When you are betrayed by your partner, you lose the coherence of the narrative of your life. And maybe the essence of the betrayal is when we rob somebody of the story of their life.
So why would I write a book about infidelity? For the same reasons that I don't think that we learn everything by just studying Apple and Google. I think that if I go to the deepest crisis in a relationship, I'll understand trust, fidelity, resilience, and how people repair. You have to have a stomach for this, to plunge into that labyrinth and stay in there. And the way that I began to look at it was, you know, what happens on the part of the person who is on the receiving end of this experience? What happens on the person who has strayed? What are the motives that lead people to do so? And what happens to the people who are often the third person in the triangle? I wrote an entire chapter on the other woman because there is no other man. Nowhere in the world is there another man. And by the way, the word homewrecker never exists in the masculine. But in Mexico, many of the men had a casa chica and a casa grande. And everybody knew exactly who lived in which one. I wrote the stories because I also have this idea that when you pick a partner, you pick a story. And of course, sometimes you are recruited for a play that you didn't audition for. But we live by the stories that we tell. And so when I meet this woman in one of the talks recently, who tells me, my boyfriend, his father cheated on his mother 20-something years ago. Do you think I should worry that that may also be part of the constitution of my boyfriend? As if this is passed through the genes. And I said to her, I don't think so, but let me ask you something else. This happened 20-something years ago. And your boyfriend tells you that his father has had a wonderful life with this new woman and that he actually has a great relationship and he's been a real model for him. What if you began the story differently? What if instead of my boyfriend's father cheated on his mother, etc., 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 my boyfriend's father was married to a woman and realized at some point that he had made a mistake, that this was not the woman with whom he should be building a whole life. And he met another partner who he thought he would love better. And that was the model that he wanted to show his children. Do you think that you will experience the legacy of this affair differently? Every affair is going to redefine a relationship. But any relationship, parents, children, you know, these are systemic issues. These are not stories of two, and they are intergenerational. But every relationship would also determine what the legacy of an affair will be. The other thing that I got very interested in was the rationalizations that we can make. How we manage to create a reality for ourselves by which we... No, you know what? I'm actually going to read you something different first. I wanted to... One of the turning points for me was around a host of categories of infidelity that I had never thought about. And it began because I read this finding that the proliferation of HIV and STD at this point, the place where it is happening the most, do you know where that is? In nursing homes. And so I got into the, you know how when you start to write a book and you come up with a little thing like that, that can take you down a vortex for a few. I spent quite a time learning that whole research and what was going on. But what it made me think about, of course, is this is not a story just that happens among young people. So here is this man. Benjamin, a mild-mannered man in his 60s, approached me after a talk in LA to ask, "Is it still called cheating when your wife no longer knows your name?" "My wife has Alzheimer's," he explained. "She's been in a nursing home for the past few years, and I visit her twice a week. For the past 14 months, I've been seeing another woman. Her husband is on the same floor. We found each other and give each other great comfort. Benjamin may be one of the nicest cheaters I have ever met. But he's by no means alone. Plenty of people care deeply for the well-being of their partners, even while lying to them, just as plenty of those who have been betrayed continue to love the ones who lied to them and want to find a way to stay together. If divorce used to carry all the stigma and the shame, today it's choosing to stay when you can leave that is the new shame. It's a bit the Hillary Clinton story. So not only did you betray me, but now I have to lie on your behalf. I have to protect you because if I'm going to go talk to my friends, they're going to judge me and all they're going to tell me is get out, throw the dog on the curb, leave. As if this has become the only option. And this new shame was so pervasive that I did this conference recently. It was just women. It's the Women's Conference of Pennsylvania. It's 12,000 women. And I read, you know, they didn't clap like you on any of the other things. No. It's very important. Except when I said that thing. That's when you know that there is a, that there is a whole recognition, you know, how many of these women... It's not that men don't do it, but that happened to be the moment when it kind of dawns on you and you just realize so many of them have made that choice, but they can't talk about it because they will be judged because today we prefer the dissolution of the entire family system with all the family bonds and we know that a marriage is not just two people. It's an entire network rather than the compromise around infidelity for the sake of everybody involved. And that notion led me to think, actually, this may not have to be the deal breaker all the time. Sometimes it is. It breaks a relationship that was dying on the vine, done. But sometimes it is a powerful alarm system that jolts people out of complacency and laziness and finally brings them back together in a level of attention that they haven't paid to each other in years. With a degree of depth and honesty and openness of conversations that has been sorely missing also for years. And those things are never talked about. You've become super quiet. So, nothing happened is the common refrain of the sexual literalists. After a few too many drinks at his co-worker Abby's birthday party, Dustin accepted her invitation to stay over. When quizzed about it the next day by his girlfriend, Leah, he repeated those words insistently. That's right. "All right, since you must know, we slept together in the same bed. But I'm telling you..." You've been there. "At one point, does nothing happen, I wonder?" Leah, meanwhile, is plagued by her own questions. Did they get naked? Did she sleep in his arms? Did he brush his nose against her sleeping face? Did he get hard? Is this really nothing? These stories make a critical point. Many affairs are less about sex than about desire. The desire to feel desired, to feel special, to be seen and connected, to compel attention. All these carry an erotic frisson that makes us feel alive, renewed, recharged. It is more energy than act, more enchantment than intercourse. And even when it comes to the act of intercourse, the adulterous defense system is impressively agile at finding loopholes. People go to great lengths to take the sex out of sex. My colleague Francesca Gentile compiled a list of some of the more imaginative completions to the sentence, "It wasn't sex because." Because I didn't know her name. I was drunk, high. I didn't enjoy it. I'm not sure I remember the details. It was with a gender I don't usually have sex with. No one else saw it. We still had our clothes on. We still had some of our clothes on. One foot was on the floor. I'm telling you, people, you can't make this shit up. There is not a word that is invented in this book. Not one word. It's 1,500 letters from the TED Talk and the hundreds and the thousands of people I've seen in the practice and around. It's just when you are the person not in an audience, but you are the partner listening to this crap, you know, you cannot believe how people suddenly, of course, they do this until the face cracks in front of them with all the raw pain that just comes gushing out. And then you realize these two seemingly irreconcilable realities right there facing each other. So I did a whole piece of work that is really what is the healing process when it is about people who want to consider the option of staying together. And I came up with three groups. There's three phases and there's three groups, but this is just to organize it, to make some structure in something that is pure chaos for quite a while. Phase one is the crisis. Phase two is the insight. And phase three is the vision for the future, together or not together. But more importantly, it's the three outcomes really were interesting to me, because I went back to people that I had seen 2, 5, 10 years ago. I mean, this is a therapist rarely gets the opportunity to do this. And to ask if some of the interventions that I had made, you know, what was the consequence of that? Some of the more daring ones and just what happened to you? Most therapists end, you know, pretty much either people are patched up back together or they have decided to split and it's the end of the process. But the way you end the relationship is always the thing you carry into your next one. And I'm very interested in how it ends. And especially if it's going to end, it doesn't necessarily mean that the relationship was a failure. This idea that success is only measured by longevity is becoming very thin. You understand what I'm saying? So in the people who stay together, there is those who I call the supplicants. And the supplicants are the ones who pretty much this event becomes the central event of their relationship. It becomes the defining feature of their entire life together. And resentment is basically like swallowing poison and waiting for the other person to die. And then there is the group which I call the survivors. And the survivors are eager to come back to their life. They won't talk about it much. This happened, it was a crisis, it was a terrible thing, it was a temporary state of insanity. We passed it, let's resume. And they're very happy to be back in stable land with their values and the family intact.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features psychotherapist and relationship expert Esther Perel, whose new book is The State of Affairs. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
And then there is a group which I called the Explorers. I've been very interested in a third category of couples, those for whom the affair becomes a catalyst for transformation. These explorers come to see infidelity as an event that, though insanely painful, contained the seeds of something positive. When faced with the collapse of the world they know, these couples home in on each other with a level of intensity that they haven't experienced in years. It's not uncommon for them to experience a combustive rekindling of desire that is a potent mixture of anxiety and lust. Fear of loss is the spark plug that sets it up. They're deeply engaged, in pain, but alive. The explorers have taught me much about what lies at the core of resilient relationships. Madison and Dennis always struck me as being that kind of couple. I remember noting during our sessions that they had an uncanny ability to express and accept a wide range of feelings without demanding premature closure. Their tolerance for ambiguity and uncertainty opened up a space for exploration in which they could more deeply reconnect. In contrast with the sufferers who conceive of their ordeal in moral absolutes, the viewpoint of the explorers is more fluid. They more readily distinguish wrong from hurtful. Paving a smoother road for clemency. When they speak about the affair, it is clear that they identify it as one event, not the definitive event in their long history together. One sign that they have successfully metabolized these events, in fact, appears in their language. They shift from you and me to our. Madison doesn't talk about when you cheated on me, but rather they talk about when we had our crisis, recounting a shared experience. Now they're joint scriptwriters sharing credit for what they produce. For Madison and Dennis, the affair has become a landmark integrated into the broader geography of their lives together. And above all, they know that there are no clear-cut answers, so they're able to discuss betrayal with a fundamental acceptance of human flaws. They understand that self-esteem or acceptance can be summed up as, I'm a flawed individual and I can still hold myself in high regard. Madison and Dennis' relationship feels much richer and more interesting, but it can also feel less secure. I'm not sure where all of this is going to take us, but dull it certainly is not, Dennis says. If before they were facing dead ends, now they don't know where they will end up. But that very fact is more exciting than frightening, and they are in it together. To repair is to repair. So, let's talk together, shall we? You can always say, I have a friend. I know someone. You know. But let's talk. Yeah, this.
So I think you discussed a little bit about how relationships have evolved from the past up until now, and I wanted to know if you could give us kind of your expert projection about what relationships will look like in the future. Like, how do these trends towards openness evolve over the next 20 to 50 years?
There are many different things happening right now, okay? The future that I can't predict is what AI is going to do to us. I'm in San Francisco, so I've, you know, but it's really true. I spent a day at Google X talking 2 days ago, and it's just like, God, I don't know where it goes. But I know a few things that are happening, right? One of the things that is an interesting question, of course, is, you know, what will happen with monogamy as defined as sexual exclusivity, right? And what does it mean to have ethical consensual non-monogamy and polyamory and all of that? You know, Typically, I'm told, you know, this doesn't work. And my first answer is, this doesn't seem to work too well either. If Apple sold you a product that fails 50% of the time, would you buy it? But this is what's happening to the marital institution that we have. And everybody understands that family constellations have shifted. We have single-parent families, gay families, surrogate families, commuter families, blended families. My God, blended families, when did that ever exist? We have a whole new genre of family configurations, but we have remained massively monolithic when it comes to the couple. And we also privilege that relationship above all others. You are incomplete, you haven't had a full life if you haven't had that kind of a relationship. And I think that one of the more interesting parts around the polyamory is that, in fact, it is an attempt of some sort to recreate community in a lifestyle that is depleted of community. So what do we have today? We have a generation of people who are the children of the boomers, moi. And that generation are often the children of the divorced and the disillusioned. I'm 35 years with the same man, but that doesn't matter. I see what happens. And there is a desire to think, how do I make this last? And how do I make it last better? And what does the better mean? The better today is that I want to have the values of freedom. No, I'm going to put first this side. I want to have the value of commitment and of stability and of security with my partner. But I also don't want it to be at the expense of losing my freedom, my creativity, my ability for self-expression. We have gone from the traditional marriage to the romantic marriage, but now we are, as Eli Finkel calls it, into the self-actualization marriage. And in the self-actualization, I am not prepared to lose certain parts of me for the sake of the commitment, which would have been completely a given in the prior generations. Of course that's a given. It's part of what it means to be together. That is not what we want. I want you to not just to give me that security, but I want you to help me become an even better version of myself. I want you to help me become my authentic self and maintain it. It's that whole piece of the self-actualization. So where we will go is in various attempts of people who will look for relational arrangements that are more transparent, that are more equal, and that makes them already more elitist. Because you cannot have this in a society where women are vulnerable. Do you understand?
Do you think that when people deny the fact that they could be at risk of divorce or infidelity, et cetera, like, you know, that could never happen to us kind of thing, that it actually puts them at more risk by denying the vulnerability that they actually make themselves vulnerable?
That's a great question. Listen, I get asked all the time, can you affair-proof a relationship? I don't think, you know, I never child-proof my house either. Because I taught, you teach the kid not to touch the thing. And so if they touch, they'll understand. You know, the notion was not about that. The notion was this desire to protect yourself from any unpredictable things that can happen, that you can control it all. So, of course, there are things which make relationships more robust. If you have more parts of yourself that are vibrant and alive in your primary relationship, you are less likely to go looking for the lost parts of yourself elsewhere. If you have conversations with partners with whom you can talk about your desires for others and your attractions, and maybe even discuss if it's okay to flirt with others and what are the boundaries, and you talk about this not after the crisis, which is what most people have those conversations for the first time, but you do it when things are good, which is really hard because how can you talk about the one and only who's meant to be everything about the fact that from the beginning you know they're not everything? But they are not, and we know it. So we lie. We lie then, but we think we've only lied here. We've been lying from the beginning. That's the thing. Because and around six, and it's a very subtle piece, but there's a profound truth around that. You know, when people have more of that space, they have more privacy. And when they have more privacy, they don't need to resort to secrecy. But at this point, the model is often either total transparency or secrecy, and the privacy has gotten lost. So, on some fundamental level, if you're going to live in the romantic model of free choice enterprise love, you need to know that at some point, it is never, never impervious that you or your partner could fall in love with somebody else. And that is a reality that you live with, and hopefully you tap into that. Of course, you hope it won't happen, and you have a commitment, and you have a sense of loyalty, and all of that. But you hope it won't happen. But I believe that in actually keeping that awareness, we would probably treat our partners much better, rather than think that they are kind of, you know, a given. Our partners never belong to us. At best, they are on loan with an option to renew. But we treat them sometimes like they are, because we collapse that anxiety. We can't stand it. It's the same way that you can't stand knowing you're going to die and then go on living. So you pretend that you are invincible. But if you actually are not pretending you're invincible, you're often more humble about the fragility of life. And I think that sometimes we need to be more humble about the fragility of our relationship, because it actually makes us invest more in our relationship and cultivate those very things that will actually keep us together and stronger. So I think that what I'm saying to you is, yes, the certain form of denial makes us more fragile.
I was just wondering if you've been able to successfully help any of your clients turn into explorers.
Yes. So, look, it's people self-select, right? Those who need to go to the lawyers, go to the lawyers. I don't see them. Those who want to be affiliated with websites for bitter, angry people who think, no, who think that I make it easy for cheaters and I let people get away with things and same stuff like that, they also find a place. I am not for everybody. But I am for all the people who have wanted to be explorers and couldn't find a place to go do so. That I do understand. And yes, I do, because I actually tell people, first of all, I say to people often, but this is a certain group, right? I'm not talking now about... I mean, I've seen the worst, just so you understand. But I also have a group of people, they're not chronic philanderers. These are people who have been perfectly faithful for quite a while, years, decades, and one day they cross a line. I don't call them cheaters. Let's begin with that. I don't know what I call them. I say, you know, you strayed, you had an affair, you had many affairs, what have you done? But I just try to find a vocabulary that is more dignifying for me, but also for their partners. And then, sometimes these people had very good relationships, and then I say that to them too. You had a good relationship. As far as I know, when marriage is concerned, you buried your parents together, you birthed your children together, you dealt with the cancer, you dealt with the economic downturns, you dealt with... For my sake and purposes, your marriage has done quite a lot of things. You're going to let this thing redefine 2 decades? For what? This is terrible, but I'm not sure that... So you're going to separate your feelings about the affair from your decisions about the marriage. That begins the process. And then the people who are explorers are people who often sit in my office and they're able to tell... There's a wonderful example of it in the new season of the podcast. She's a sex educator. She goes to go and get her tests at the doctor, and she comes back with an STI. You know, that from the husband, right? And what is amazing in the session, you'll hear it, is that they go in and out of the rage, the hurt, the disbelief, the how am I ever going to trust you again? And then the next minute she's able to talk about the kind of man he is, how he came out of his childhood, how the two of them who had experienced so much trauma together really build a family, how they're there for their children. And that ability to see the person still in its entirety, rather than it being just reduced by this to this one thing only, is a real feature of the explorers. They go in and out of it, but it's you hear it. They're able to still say, you know, while all of this was going on, he was helping me with this project that I was doing, and I didn't believe, and I'm doing it because of her or him, or it's, you know, two men, two women, it's, you know, it doesn't, those dialogues are really not gender specific. They are about the ability to hold the whole picture in front of you, and the ability also to, what I read to you, the nuance, the ambiguity, that it's not an all or nothing. Then the ability sometimes to know that it wasn't about me, that it's not if I had been more of this and more of that, that it's not rooted in one person doing something more for the other. The most important thing that explorers do very well is that whenever you have a crisis like this, the scorecard of a relationship is lit. And that means that the person who did not stray, that doesn't mean that person didn't have all kinds of things they would have wanted to change. But they didn't do this. And they often accepted all kinds of things. And now they have their right for greater entitlement. And it's very good. It's very good. Because now they get to see, because the person who strays, by definition, when you stray, you are rebelling and you are doing a resounding no. No to the status quo, no to the deadness of my life, no to the fact that I've become a full-time mother and wife and this and that and I haven't remembered what my name is, no to my feelings of oppression and suffocation, whatever, no. And you think that you're the only one who's saying no and that the other person is okay with it, which is not true. Those are roles that people create in a relationship. So it makes this person finally say, I have some things that I want as well. And that becomes the renegotiation for the relationship, which led me to always say, most of us today in the West are going to have two or three relationships, marriages, committed relationships. Some of us are going to do it with the same person. Your first marriage may be over. Do you want another one with each other? Thank you. Thank you.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was psychotherapist and relationship expert Esther Perel, whose new book is The State of Affairs. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Brandon Battaglia, Dan Folds, Alex Espelet, and Lincoln Andrews. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.